Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI tells the faithful that only by practicing charity can we also take part in the joy of our Lord. Liberia's president pledges reconciliation after a divisive runoff in which she was the only candidate. We shine the light on the background of the disputed election and on the mood of the people as they struggle to heal the wounds left by a bloody civil war. The United Nations appeals to the international community to take preventive measures to stop Sudan attacking its neighbour, South Sudan, Africa's newest nation. And the Pontifical Council's Courtyard of the Gentiles project extends its walls to Albania. Pope Benedict XVI reflected on the theme of charity on Sunday while addressing those gathered to pray the Angelus in St. Peter's Square. He reminded them that only by practicing charity can we also take part in the joy of our Lord. And as Lydia O'Kane reports, he asked for prayers to accompany him on his upcoming pastoral journey to the African nation of Benin.
God summons every man to life and bestows on him a talent, while entrusting him with a mission, which is charity. Those were Pope Benedict XVI's words before the Angelus in St. Peter's Square. The Pope reminded those gathered on Sunday that charity is the fundamental good that no one can fail to make use of, and without which all the other gifts are in vain, before adding that only by practicing charity can we also take part in the joy of our Lord. During his address, the Holy Father also underlined the fact that because our earthly existence is marked by impermanence, our life should be lived as a pilgrimage, and we should keep our eyes fixed on the ultimate goal, the God who created us. Recalling Sunday's Gospel, Pope Benedict also continued on the theme of charity, noting that it was our mission to use our talents for the good of others.
In today's Gospel, the parable of the talents, Jesus invites us to reflect his gratitude on the gifts we have received and to use them wisely for the growth of God's kingdom. May his words summon us to an ever deeper conversion of mind and heart and a more effective solidarity in the service of all our brothers and sisters.
After reciting the Marian prayer, the Holy Father had a number of special greetings in a number of languages. Giving greetings in Polish, the Holy Father recalled that on this November 13th, the Church in Poland was remembering the Day of Solidarity for the Persecuted Church, which this year is asking for prayers in particular for the Church in Sudan. Drawing his address to a conclusion, the Pope, speaking in French, invited the faithful to pray for his forthcoming visit to Benin and urged solidarity with those who work for peace, justice and reconciliation on the continent of Africa. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for that report. Liberia's President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has pledged a reconciliation after a highly divisive runoff in which she was the only candidate. With 86% of the votes counted, Sirleaf is on a 91% after her rival, Winston Tubman, boycotted the election. He alleged that the poll, seen as a test for Liberia's fragile democracy, was rigged in Sirleaf's favour. But foreign observers condemned his decision to boycott the election, saying it was well organised. Turnout in last Tuesday's poll was over 37%, about half the number who turned out for the election's first round last month. Sirleaf won the most votes in that round, but failed to gain an outright majority, forcing a runoff. With such a low turnout and no majority in Parliament, her task promises to be all the more difficult. Sirleaf first won elections in 2005, following the end of a civil war that saw former leader Charles Taylor, now on trial at The Hague for war crimes, forced out of power. Sean Patrick Lovett, head of Vatican Radio's English programme, was very recently in Liberia, teaching a communications course in the country's major seminary and working with Radio Veritas. I asked him to share with me his impressions of the nation, of its people, as they prepared to cast their ballots in last week's runoff election. You were actually in Liberia at a very crucial time, right up against the run-up election, and I really wanted to know from you what your feeling was whilst in Liberia regarding the mood there, the people, the expectations, whether they're positive or not.
I can still see the sights, I can hear the sounds, I can smell the smells of Liberia. It's that close to me. And it's over the last few days, obviously, it being in the news, it's something I've been thinking about a lot. I spent some time in the capital, Monrovia, but I was also lucky enough to spend some time up in the north of the country, about 4 hours' drive in a place called Banga, which is really, it's in the rainforest, in the jungle. That's where the major seminary is. I was teaching a communications course there and working with Radio Veritas in Monrovia. I say that because they're two very different realities. A capital city, the dynamic, the feeling inside a capital city is very different from what it is 4 hours' drive way up inside the rainforest. What strikes you when you listen to people, when you look around you, the scars are very present. The physical scars, because you see the war veterans going around in their wheelchairs without limbs in the middle of the street, and physical scars in the people, but the emotional scars are still very much there. Technically, the war ended in 2003, 2004, but it's still in their eyes, it's still in their hearts. That's the downside. The downside is that it makes it very difficult to talk to people about things that are essential to us, like your family and your home and where you come from, because you know that it's very likely the person you're talking to saw their family murdered in front of them, had their house burned down not once, not twice, but three times by one of the rival rebel groups. The radio station was burned down twice. So the pain is still there, and that in a sense that's the downside. But it's a reality. That's what it is. It's a country coming out of a dreadful war situation where over 250,000 people died, dispersed, refugees, and all that horror. The upside is that they, because of that, there's this huge desire to leave it behind and get on with it. And I think that's what swept Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to power in 2005. And I believe that's what will bring her back and has brought her back this time. They call her the woman. They don't refer to her by name. And there's something enigmatic about that as well. The fact that it's a woman who's able to pull this mess together and reconcile these otherwise irreconcilable groups. She's more than a president. She's this maternal figure, who offers a ray of hope. The only person who looks like she's able to pull it together and make it work. And there's this huge desire, as I say, to leave the past and to move forward, to do something with this country.
Well, she's got a very difficult job ahead of her. She's been at the helm for just over 5 years, and there's still a lot of inequality, obviously, and there's still a lot to pull together. I was reading her posters, her campaign posters, which say, "When the plane hasn't landed yet, don't change the pilots."
People, well, just while you're on posters, well, they say votes, not guns. That's the one you see around Monrovia. Out in the countryside, there's a poster that reads, "Focus on the issues and not the personalities," which I find very intelligent.
Which was also for her party, or for her.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
She was also running up against a very popular figure, who's Weah, who
George
everyone
Weah
knows because of his football stardom. And The turnout was very low in this runoff election. But do you think she is a popular figure? Do you think the people like her? Even the Nobel Peace Prize.
It's a leading question. Oh, yeah, well, the Nobel Peace Prize was an issue when I was there because obviously the opposition thought the timing was shocking. It shouldn't have come when it did. The people out in the rainforests don't know that she won the Nobel Prize. They don't know what a Nobel Prize is. They're far more concerned with getting enough food to eat and getting their kids off to the mission school or whatever structure that there is out there. So that's why that the Monrovia experience is one thing. Once you get outside the capital, it really is another reality.
Which is the most part of the country.
Which is where most of the people are, yes. Even bringing them to an awareness that there is an election underway, that there is this person. There are no televisions, so there are no radio stations. Where I was in the jungle, there was electricity for 2 hours a day. It comes and goes in the capital, in Monrovia. There's very little running water. You're talking about basic subsistence conditions here. So how a popular figure, as we understand a popular political figure, doesn't exist.
Are the people literate?
The literacy is she has been very good at building roads, so communications, linking places, and the schooling, the education. She has really boosted the educational system. So you have these lines of little children walking sometimes miles and miles to school every day, and you know that all they have to eat for the day is a banana. And when they get home at night, they're not going to be able to study much because when the sun goes down, there's no light to study by. But I'm not being negative by saying that. That's the reality. You have to take that into consideration. But the spirit behind it, the desire, the will to go forward, to do something, to educate your children, to go beyond, is incredibly strong. And I think that's what's behind her. The fact that it's her or someone else wouldn't make a lot of difference. The important thing is that whoever it is represents change for good.
And staying with news from Africa, UN Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay has called for an investigation into the bombing of a refugee camp in South Sudan, a nation which became independent in July. The UN has accused Sudan of carrying out the attack in the oil-rich Unity State, which is just south of its border. Khartoum, which is fighting pro-southern rebels on its side of the frontier, denies the allegation. South Sudanese officials say at least 12 people were killed in the air raid. There are about 20,000 refugees camped in the region after fleeing violence in southern Kordofan and Blue Nile provinces north of the border. And violence along the poorly defined border since South Sudan's independence in July has strained ties between the two former civil war enemies. They are accusing one another of backing rebel groups on their sides of the border. Speaking to Christopher Wells, Christian Solidarity Worldwide's team leader for Africa and the Middle East, Dr. Katasa Gondwe describes the bombings as a major international incident.
There have been continual bombings in Sudan, particularly in areas which have yet to be determined whether they'll stay with the north or go to the south. There's been bombings in the Nuba Mountains. There have been bombings, and that's in South Kordofan. And there have been bombings in Blue Nile, all these border states. But what happened on the 10th was that there was a bombing of refugees from these areas who had fled into South Sudan, which is now an independent state. This bombing happened, I'm informed, an hour after a UN helicopter had landed in the area to bring food aid. So it was actually witnessed by some aid workers, and there's corroborative evidence for this. A plane that is thought to have been an Antonov bomber circled several times before releasing, I'm told, between 2 to 5 bombs, one of which is still unexploded and jammed into a school building. Fortunately, from what we're hearing, there have been no casualties, but this is a major violation of the sovereignty of South Sudan, and it's basically almost an act of war. And worse than that, it could be an international crime, because you don't bomb refugee camps. This camp is called Yida, and it houses 20,000 refugees from the Nuba Mountains and also from Blue Nile. So this is a major international incident.
Now, has anybody offered a justification for the bombing? I understand the North is denying that they're responsible.
Yeah, they're denying it, but it's hardly likely that they're not responsible. There's nobody else who would be flying an Antonov bomber and rolling out bombs from there. They have been bombing further up in the region. They've been bombing the border states in the same way as this place was bombed. It is highly unlikely that anybody else could have done this, and their denials are really not very convincing.
And what's provoking the current round of violence?
Well, it's difficult to describe what is provoking it, because if you look at it on the surface, it just seems to be mindless, as if the North has no policy and no even cognizance of what it's doing. However, it seems, if you look at the history of the Northern Sudan, whenever there has been a problem in the center, for example, at the moment the economy is collapsing, food prices are increasing, and there's a complete failure of policy in Northern Sudan, political policy, economic policy, they seem to be distracting or trying to distract attention by starting a war elsewhere, creating some kind of enemy somewhere else to distract attention from policy failures. And I think this is one of the instances. I think this is a really desperate move on the part of the North to distract attention from its own problems and, in its own territory, because otherwise it makes absolutely no sense at all. And it seems it wants to expand this war, because the Satellite Sentinel project has confirmed that, according to some of the imagery that it has viewed recently, that Sudan is already trying to upgrade some of the airfields in the area it's seized in Blue Nile. And this can only be in preparation for easier bombing of the south. So they seem quite determined to go down this path.
So what would you say are the prospects of actual war breaking out between South Sudan and Sudan?
Well, South Sudan has been pretty patient. In May, the North invaded Abyei and displaced a lot of people. Their troops are still there. And they have tried not to react, really, in kind to what has been done. But it gets to a stage where there's almost no other alternative but war. And this is what we want to avoid. So this is why we're calling on members of the international community who guaranteed the peace agreement between North and South, who guaranteed and oversaw the transition to freedom of the South, to actually rise up now and put pressure on the North and stop them from doing what they're doing. There has to be a no-fly zone instituted in the border areas between these two states. And this should include South Kordofan and also Blue Nile State. Without that, these bombings are going to continue, and eventually there's going to be some kind of reaction.
Do you see any international will to actually go in and enforce a no-fly zone, or in other ways to put pressure on Sudan to stop attacks like this?
Sadly, I don't. The international community talk a good talk, but they never actually put their money where their mouth is, so to speak. This is something that could be easily solved if there was the will to do it, but it seems that Sudan is a lower priority than, for example, Libya was, which is really quite distressing to watch.
And is there anything else that you'd like to add as far as what's happening in the immediate future or what more can be done?
As I said before, it just takes the international community, key members of the international community who have the capacity to do this, to actually institute this no-fly zone, and then also to bring the two parties together for talks, so that not just talks, but to resolve Abyei, to resolve Blue Nile status, to resolve the status also of South Kordofan in a peaceable manner. This is what should have been done long ago, when there was much more leverage on the North. We can just hope and pray that there is enough leverage now to push the North to such an extent that it will not sort of take this whole thing to its logical conclusions and actually reignite a war through its behaviour.
That was Dr. Kataza Gondwe, Christian Solidarity Worldwide's team leader for Africa and the Middle East. A two-day Court of the Gentiles project began today, Monday the 14th, in Tirana, the capital city of Albania. The project is sponsored by the Pontifical Council for Culture, whose president is Cardinal Gianfranco Ravasi. My friend and colleague Veronica Scarsbrick asked Dr. Richard Rouse, who heads this council's Department for Languages and Communications, about the ongoing encounter.
Dr. Rouse, Pope Benedict called for a Courtyard of the Gentiles project in 2009 in an effort to promote dialogue between believers and non-believers. It was picked up by the head of your council, Cardinal Gianfranco Ravasi. Can you explain briefly the concept of the project he spearheaded?
Yes, the project is the Courtyard of the Gentiles. The idea is quite simply to raise the discussions about belief in the world today, particularly in two areas. The first area is that of religious indifference and ignorance. A lot of the secularized Western European, but also other countries who have been under the duress of a laïcité, a secularist mentality, have a religious knowledge and which is very weak, and they have an understanding of religious ideas which is often wrong. And so the idea is to start talking again about the presence of religion and what religion can do and can be for each and every person.
This project started in 2009. What do you think have been the main highlights so far? The Notre Dame event, perhaps, in Paris?
Yes, the Notre Dame event was the first official moment of the dialogue, and we had this wonderful experience on the forecourt of Notre Dame with all of these tents and young people from across the city who came for all sorts of reasons to talk, to listen, to converse, for theatre, for shows, for music. And there was a wonderful Sole Lumiere spectacle with light and sound, which was a great historical moment. But then what was particularly interesting was that the cathedral opened its doors to all of these people out there, and they came in and they listened and they learnt about religious worship, and they didn't just stand there gawping, but they became engaged.
Moving on from the 14th to the 15th of November, the Courtyard of the Gentiles project travels to Albania, a nation where Christianity is among the two major religions together with Islam, which takes the lion's share because of its history tied to centuries of Ottoman rule. Until 1990, this nation underwent 47 years of communist rule, with ensuing effects on religious practice on generations. Interestingly, then, with the backdrop of this scenario, the theme of this encounter in the nation's capital, Tirana, focuses around what non-believers believe in. What do they believe in?
Well, that's why we're going there, to ask them. It's always useful in a dialogue to actually listen to the people you're talking to. So we're going to ask them, what do you believe in? But that in itself is almost a little trick in the question, because we're enticing them, we're inviting them to examine their consciences, to examine what it is that they want from life. You mentioned there that Albania has this wonderful history, and one of the key ideas we're using is that it is a nation that tried to kill God and failed. And you can see this because there's a wonderful religious presence there. There are all of the religions living peacefully side by side. And that's a wonderful beginning testimony for what is going on. But there is also this level of religious ignorance which needs to be encountered. And the beginning of engagement is, of course, dialogue.
On the 14th, this encounter is focusing its attention on young people. The courtyard becomes the public square right next to the cathedral, and you have young people who are given an opportunity to debate issues focusing around various themes. That takes place with both civil and religious authorities, right?
Yes, that's right. And the themes are work and spirituality and communications. These are themes that we think young people are interested in. It's the same idea as we used in Paris, where we have these tents, and the young people will go in and they will discuss together within these tents on these themes. And then afterwards, they'll be drawn together in a more public ceremony where the religious leaders, both Catholics and Orthodox, but also the Muslim community, they will speak on these themes and engage with the youth.
The courtyard of the second day is the European University of Tirana. It'll be a highbrow event, won't it?
You know, having started in Paris, we started there at the Sorbonne and the Académie Française, so we've still got this remnant of high philosophical dialogue, and that's an important part of what we're doing.
Which the Pope Benedict promotes this, yes. Incredibly, doesn't he?
Yes, we are, after all, the Council for Culture, but that culture is in two elements. It's culture, it is highbrow culture. You have to go to the very heart of the questions, the deep, difficult sometimes questions, but it's also popular culture. So we're trying to do it in such a way as to engage with the people. Interestingly, in Albania, there's not just one or two small universities. There are many universities. It's a country which is very creative. It's a country which has great opportunities for the future and that is investing strongly in its educational possibilities. So that's an exciting reality that we're keen to work together with.
I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.
Thanks there to Veronica Scaresbrick, who was speaking to Dr. Richard Rouse, head of the Pontifical Council for Culture's Department for Languages and Communications. That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.